We're up to Daniel chapter 6, and recognizing some of these realities about, you know, just lunchtime and so forth, I thought we would do something here with Daniel chapter 6 that's a little bit different than what we've done up to this point. Just think for a second before, I've got something that we're going to do kind of like as a group thing in a bit. But just before we get into that, let's recognize some of the realities or think through this a little bit. Where are we at in the story, let's say in the biblical story? Like, what is the timing here? What is the chronology? What has happened? Can we just get some context a little bit? Where are we? What's going on? Anybody want to give a general idea? Give me some help. Where are we at this point in the story so far? Okay, great. New kingdom has just happened. Chapter 5, the Babylonians just fell. Chapter 6, Medes and Persians have just taken over. So new kingdom. Great. We can even think even broader than that. Like, where in the whole big picture? Are the 12 disciples alive at this time? You know, that kind of thing. Yeah, a couple hundred years before Christ. Excellent. And when you're thinking about Daniel's life, we're ranging from like 605 BC up into like the 530s or so, right? 605 to 530. So yeah, about 500 years before Jesus is going to come. Good. What else? Okay, good. At this point, Daniel chapter 6, he's an old man, right? Okay, excellent. What else? Exile. Thank you. Good. We're looking for that definitely. Exile. So if I want to say the biblical story in the biggest, broadest terms, I'm going to say something like, God had made promises to Abraham that he would establish a nation. Then after Abraham's time, a couple of generations go by down to Jacob and Joseph. Children of Israel moves down, or the nation of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, move down to Egypt. They multiply. God calls Israel out of Egypt, and that's when they become a nation, really. That's the birth of the nation, Sinai, right? This is Moses. Okay, so that period until through Joshua and the judges setting up the promised land, setting up the nation in their homeland, that's kind of feeling pretty hopeful, pretty optimistic. They have their land. God has fulfilled his promises. Now, you talk about Exodus, you talk about Leviticus, you talk about Deuteronomy, there's lots of failure in there too, right? Deuteronomy put in 2017 terms means take two. Let's try this again. Right? Because in Exodus, they tried to go into the promised land. This is that story where they go and they see their enemies and they say, we can't do it, and they give up and they leave. So Deuteronomy is like, take two, we can do this, let's try this again. So there's some kind of discouraging things, end of Judges, some really disgusting things. So there's some problems. But there's this kind of optimistic feeling God is setting up his nation in the promised land. Okay, the passage of years, Solomon, David, it's like 1100,000 BC. Okay, so about 1000 BC, from there until Daniel, we've got about 400 years. And in that 400 years, you've got king after another. A lot of ups and downs, but it's kind of like the stock market going the wrong way. Ups and downs, up and down, up and down, but it's not going well. Until you reach this point that Israel, other tribes, they're destroyed a couple hundred years before this, or 120 years before this. Then now Judah is conquered and destroyed, and all of that is the judgment of God. So that's kind of the big, broad picture overall. I don't know what I'm doing here to make this come to life, but maybe, who knows? Jonathan, do you know how to make the projector live? I don't know if I hold something down or what I'm pressing wrong. Maybe in a little bit I'll show you. We can kind of get this in perspective with the other prophets that are alive at this time. So during Daniel's time, Jeremiah is alive just in his early part of his life. Ezekiel is alive in the middle of his life. And right after is coming Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah are going to be after Daniel. Daniel's life is happening. So that's a little bit of a big picture. Any questions that you want to understand about how this fits into other pieces of the story? All right. No problem. Great. When I get to Daniel chapter 5, One of the things, or Daniel chapter 6, excuse me. One of the things that should strike me right away is Daniel is still in a position of influence. That's something that should be amazing. Why do I say that? Oh, here we go. Because among other things, Daniel was this person of influence in Babylon. That's the last administration. And generally what happens is, if you're a person of any influence in the last kingdom, they come and kill all those guys, start over with a new fresh bunch, because they were loyal to the last guy, get rid of them, and get somebody who's loyal to you. Right. That would be the assumption. And it's extraordinary, it's amazing, even the history, the secular history, verifies this, that this revolution or this takeover was pretty bloodless. It killed the king, killed a few other people right around him. But then the attitude of the Medes and the Persians was, well, you already have some organization here, and we'll incorporate some of that. We'll incorporate the best parts of the old right into the new. And that's apparently what they did. Historically, we know that. That explains why Daniel is still alive and in a position of influence when I come into chapter 6. That's kind of the historical or the human standpoint. I think the narrative of Daniel is here to tell you, from a divine preservation standpoint, God is just carrying Daniel right through all these events of history. Right? There are times when it looks like Daniel will be killed. There are times when it looks like Daniel has been forgotten. Chapter 5, Belshazzar. You are that Daniel? Right? Times when he has been forgotten. But the whole time, God is feeding him through the labyrinth of history up to this point where Cyrus is going to take over the kingdom. One thing I want to talk about here, but before I do that, I'll do this first, just to show you, this is a timeline. I'm sorry, it's kind of small, and there's only so much we can do to be able to, well, you're trying to fit a lot of information on a small screen, but this is Daniel's lifetime, so you can see Ezekiel in relation to that, Jeremiah in relation to that, some of the other prophets that you recognize, and some of the rulers that you recognize, Haggai, Zechariah, and then you're going to, all the way down to Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament. Okay, so let's see. I don't know where Ezra and Nehemiah should be on here. Let's do this. Just go down to the books. Okay, so this would be actually the time, like that says Daniel. That's the time when probably Daniel was written, not when Daniel was alive. And just following him would be Ezra and Nehemiah. Far enough along that Daniel's life did not overlap with theirs, but far enough along that they would have been aware of each other, close enough together. So that's just some ideas. In the big picture as well, if I go back to everything here, you can see the different major events that happen. So right here, this is the Cyrus Edict. That's the scroll that I showed you. Make this bigger. That's the Cyrus Edict that I showed you. Here's the temple that Ezra and Nehemiah are going to work on. But if we come out here, that's in context against the time that we're talking about here. Here we go. Daniel, right here, that's his life. And this is at the end of his life, right at the end of his life when the Cyrus Edict is going to happen. So within, here's one more piece of that. There's the different destructions of the Jerusalem. So this is the first deportation, 605. That was Daniel's time. Daniel was taken in the first deportation. You have several more waves of it that are going on. Well, recognize that when you're looking at Daniel's life, this is the beginning when he's young. He got taken in the first one. But as he's living in Babylon all these years, every 5, 10, 20 years, there's another group of Jews that arrive in the city. I mean, he's the first, some part of the very first group. Every couple of years, here comes another wave. Here comes another group. There's more people coming. And he's hearing in the news, if you want to say it that way, he's hearing that there was another destruction of Jerusalem, his hometown. The whole time he's living a couple hundred miles away, and he's hearing about what's happening to his hometown. During his life, these kinds of things are going on. Anyway, my goal there is to give us a little sense of kind of the history, or that this is real life stuff. This really happened in the real world. Okay, one thing to talk about here before we jump into Daniel chapter 6 and do some other things is a discussion about who is Darius. And I'm not going to do a whole lot with this. If you want to get into it more, I've got a lot of discussion back in the back of the book, in that section 3. There is a section titled, Who is Darius the Mede? And that's what we're talking about here. Who is this guy? And there's been a lot of discussion, kind of like what I said earlier about Belshazzar, where a liberal would say, there was no Darius. That was a big mistake. Right? At one time, they said, Daniel doesn't know what he's talking about, and this proves that Daniel is not really historic. There is no Darius. And there are a couple of different options for how to understand Darius. With time, there's some evidence that seems to really help us understand much better. I would argue, and you can see this if you want to get into it further in the book, my argument would be that Darius is actually Cyrus. Darius and Cyrus are the same guy. If that's a little confusing to you, it could be because at the end of this chapter, end of chapter 6, you'll see the last verse of the chapter. And it says this, Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, and some translations will say, during the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. This Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. I translated here, Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, even in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And that Hebrew, that Aramaic word can be translated either way. So it's a translation thing. Are you going to say Darius and Cyrus, like two guys, or are you going to say, like, Pastor Threlfall, husband of Krista? Well, you know, same thing, right? So you can say it either way, and that could be read either way. Darius and Cyrus, two guys, or Darius, meaning Cyrus. And what the possibility of this is that Darius is possibly like a pharaoh kind of title. In other words, you say pharaoh, that's not like the guy's name. That's not like Jonathan Threlfall. Pharaoh is a title. It's like president. Okay, so lots of people would get called pharaoh. Lots of people could get called the Rabshakeh in Isaiah. That's actually probably a title. In other words, that guy was the Rabshakeh at that time. Versus Mr. Rabshakeh, it's like a title. Okay, so that possibly is what's going on with Darius. Because we've discovered with time, lots of people getting called Darius or even kind of called the Darius. Okay? So we may be looking at Cyrus in this chapter, that he's actually spending time with the actual Cyrus. The other possibility is that Darius is a guy underneath Cyrus. Cyrus is the main king and Darius is like the secondary, the one that ruled in this area or over this province. But my preference would be for what I just said, that this is actually Darius is Cyrus the king. Okay. Here's what we'll do. I have some scripts here, and we're going to make this a play. I have already assigned one part, and what you will do, I have made this as simple as I can do. I highlighted out the text. And what you would do if you were assigned this part, this is the evil men. So if I was assigned the evil men, then when I come to the highlighting part, I read that part. That's it. It's that simple. Okay, so your job at that point would be just to read that. Pastor Threlfall, could we maybe get the handheld that work or something? I'm sorry. Passing off kids and everything, I'm sorry. Make that complicated for y'all. So if you are assigned that part, you just read when your highlighting comes up. Here's why I like doing this. I like doing it because it makes it feel like a play. Versus just reading the text, make it like a play. I've even done this a couple of times with friends. Try this. Get together with a group of friends and read through a book of the Bible and assign parts. Okay, so there was this one Sunday where it was a snow Sunday, and Sarah and I got together with some friends of ours. It was before we had kids, and they didn't have kids, so it was four of us, and we did the book of Job. And each person got one of the friends, and then somebody was the narrator, and somebody was Job. And we read through the book of Job together. It was a lot of fun. It's a lot more interesting to do it that way. Okay, so I highly recommend that as just a possibility, and that's what we'll try to do today. I need a volunteer for somebody to be Daniel. I need a volunteer for somebody to be the king. And I need a volunteer for somebody to be the evil men. So who wants to do what? Who wants to be, let's start, the evil men? Who wants
hello,
to be that?
Hello, hello.
Excellent. Okay, I have a script for you here. Who wants to be the king? You seem pretty kingly. You seem pretty kingly. That'll be great. And then Daniel. We just need one. Yeah, people pass around. That'll work. Oops. Who's going to be Daniel? Great. He beat you. I'm sorry. Okay. All right, and I asked my mother to be the narrator, because my mother, I know her, and she's a good narrator. So I'll ask you guys to come up. We'll just run through this script as we go. When you come to your part, you read your part. We're reading this like a play. I want to invite all of us to participate in it and see the drama in it. See the drama of the play in each figure as they contribute. Okay, so there we got Daniel. Y'all got your scripts. All right. Okay, we're calling in the Hanover Baptist Church classic players to perform for us. Daniel chapter 6. Let's hear a round of applause for the Hanover classic players. Okay, let's begin.
It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the...
Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God.
Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him,
King Darius, live forever, and the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not.
Wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree.
Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?
The king answered and said,
The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not.
Then answered they and said before the king,
That Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition 3 times a day.
Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king,
Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king established may be changed.
Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel,
Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee.
And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet, and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste into the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel,
O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions?
Then said Daniel unto the king,
O king, live forever. My God hath sent his angel, and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt.
Then was the king exceeding glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. And the king commanded, and they brought these men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. And the lions had the mastery of them, and brake all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, Peace be
multiplied unto you, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and steadfast forever. And his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who have delivered Daniel from the power of lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian.
Let's give a round of applause to you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Now, that's just an idea for a way to do stuff with Bible reading. If you want to try that, even try that like as a way of getting together with people. And just, it's a fun way to read through the Bible. It's really, really a fun way to engage with the text. So that's just an idea. Let's think about a couple of details as we start going through the chapter that maybe you've wondered about before. And what I'm going to do here, I'm going to give you a picture. It's a little bit of a shocking picture. So this might be the only time a picture like this has come up at Hanover Baptist Church, and I'll apologize for it ahead of time. Okay, see if you can, if it's okay with you. I want you to look at the picture, and I want you to kind of criticize, because this is classic art for Daniel and the Lion's Den. If you go to, you know, a museum or something, this is one of the pictures that's famous for Daniel and the Lion's Den. I want you to criticize the picture. Dates are very well established historically. So a good 74 years has gone by. This is one of the reasons that we argue Daniel was probably 14 years old back in chapter 1. Because if he's much older than that, then he's going to be like 100 years old by the time he gets to chapter 6. Right? So he's probably, based on this construction, probably around 88, 90 years old. Okay? And basically, we'll just say he doesn't look like that. It does not look like that. What else? Yeah. From the details of the chapter, it said that God has shut the mouths of the lion. That lion looks like he's ready to take somebody's head off, right? I don't think that fits the details of the chapter, really. Okay, good. What else? Yeah. Daniel looks petrified. Daniel is scared to death. And I don't think that, in fact, here's something to talk about. It's just a fascinating detail. Look up at verse 20. As the king came to the lion's den to Daniel, he cried out with a sound of anguish. The king has been up all night. The king has been stressed out about what was going to happen, right? And he comes into the tomb with a cry of anguish. Daniel's response to him when he comes, Daniel spoke with the king, verse 21, O king, live forever, which is like the polite greeting, right? The official expected social thing. So I'm thinking, if I'm in a den full of lions, and somebody finally comes up the next morning to see how I'm doing, oh, Daniel, are you okay? You know, probably my response is something like, get me out of here, right? Daniel's response is, good morning, sir. How was your night? That's sort of the Englishization of this, you know. Good morning, sir. Hope you had a good night. It's a polite answer, okay? And he's giving the polite greeting before he goes ahead and explains this well-reasoned, gives reasons. It's a whole sentence, a whole explanation. It's not just like, get me out of here right now. So I think the king is the one actually in this whole event that was stressed out. The king is the one that got no sleep, and from what we can tell from the passage, Daniel gets in the lion's den and probably got a good night's rest. Okay. I mean, at minimum, what we know here is in the morning, he's polite, and he's not stressed out at all. Okay, so that definitely doesn't fit. Daniel shouldn't be stressed out. I can think of two more things that are wrong with the picture. Anybody else? I think I have three things. Yeah, Daniel is Jewish. This guy looks like he's like Western European. Okay, so Why? Because the Europeans painted it, of course. So, you know, we always make the pictures look like ourselves. So that's a problem. I think the lion's den, from what you can tell, it says in verse 24, they were thrown down and they did not reach the bottom of the den. So probably you're looking more like a pit versus this just kind of looks like, I don't know, a sort of low place. You can see sky in the background. So more like a hole dug in the ground. And the way they would do this, from what we can tell historically, that they just wouldn't feed the lions for a while. And the lions are incredibly hungry. You don't feed them, and then when you throw somebody in there, they're just gone, because the lion's looking for something to eat right away. Okay, so that doesn't seem to fit. And then the last thing that I think, my viewpoint that I think is wrong with this picture, is that Daniel should have on more clothes. Okay, so that's it. So a couple of things wrong with the picture. I'll get it off the screen because I don't like looking at it either. All right. And that gives me sort of a background maybe for putting some of the other pieces of the picture or the chapter together. So here, let me ask you this. Why do you think these men are so desperate to destroy Daniel? Okay, verse 4, they're looking to find a charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. They're not able to find anything. But why are they so desperate to find something? You find any kind of, anyway, just an explanation. What's going on here? Jealousy. Excellent. Jealousy. Why would they be jealous? Well, he's got a high position, right? And anybody who's in a high position, everybody around them is trying to get him down, right? That's the way that, not a lot about human nature has changed. Okay. So that makes sense. I think you're right on track. Jealousy. Give me some more reasons why they would be jealous. Excellent. Nailed. Right on. See, you've got a whole pattern that's developed now for five chapters. Right? Chapter 1, Daniel is just one in the whole group of refugees, but he and his friends are put right up at the top. Right? In fact, they're given a choice position in the king's cabinet at like 15, 16 years old. How does that feel if you're the 65-year-old guy that served the king for 4 decades now? Right? And you've worked your way up, scrapped your way up, worked hard for 4 decades to get there in the seniority. You've not made it yet to that position. You're almost there. So they stick a 16-year-old foreigner into the position. No thank you. Right? Chapter 2, they almost all get killed. Daniel saves their life. But in the process, Daniel becomes the chief of the magicians. So think about this. We said it was during his education, his 3-year education, it was in the middle, right? So you've got a guy, one day he comes in on Thursday to class, and he's teaching the class, and here's the students, a bunch of kids, right? 15, 16-year-old kids. Okay. The next day, the next week, he walks in to the office of that student and has to report to him for duty. Thursday, I was your teacher, and the next Monday, you're my boss. Not the most comfortable thing in the world, right? And Daniel, foreigner, 16, 17-year-old now, is exalted above all these other guys. Get into chapter 5, you have the same thing. Nobody else can interpret the dream. So at this point, there is some accumulated frustration that has happened across an extended period of time. Here's another piece of that. That's related, I already alluded to it, but just notice this detail in verse 13. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is from the exiled sons of Judah, does not pay attention to you concerning you, O king. Okay, that's pretty striking to me because of this. Daniel, at this point, has lived in Babylon for like 70 years. Okay, he's an old man. He has been in Babylon longer than most of them have been, well, we don't know for sure, but probably most of them have been alive. 70 years is a long time, right? It's kind of like I met somebody in Georgia, I think it was. I met somebody in Georgia and we were at a church dinner. And she had a very noticeable New England accent, really strong New England accent. And we're this very southern church in South Georgia. So we're sitting around the table, and some different people in the church were teasing her as a foreigner, as a Yankee. Right? They're teasing her as a Yankee, she's not a southerner, and kind of giving her a hard time about it. And at some point, she looked up and she said, well, you can say what you want, but I've lived in Georgia longer than any of y'all have been alive. And it was true. I've been in the South longer than you have been. You may be Southern, but I've lived here longer than you have. Okay, and nobody says anything after that. How do you answer that one? That's sort of Daniel's situation. That maybe he's not from there, meaning all that means is their first 14 years of his life, where he was born, was a different country. But he's lived in Babylon all these years. Why is it after 70 years you still call him a foreigner? Why is he still a foreigner? In fact, at this point, this kingdom it's got a lot of different nationalities in it. It's a lot of different people and people groups in the city. So why do you have to bring out this issue, the refugee from the exiled sons of Judah? Well, it's kind of demeaning a little bit. You know that refugee? And I think the text is going beyond that. I think the text is telling us that there's something here about hatred toward the Jew, God's people. Hatred toward those that God intended to be a light to the nations. There's something special going on. Which leads me to this. Let's say this. God working and blessing his people. Here's a pattern that's worth noticing. You'll have to go back with me just to look at the end of each chapter. And this is an important detail because we'll return here later on. Let's look at the end of chapter 1. Okay, Daniel arrives in Babylon as a refugee. Arriving in Babylon as a refugee, chapter 1 starts out and he's nobody. And at the end of chapter 1, we read verse 19, "Therefore, they stood before the king as his personal attendants." So, that's why I put this up here. Daniel got a promotion. He used to be just a refugee. Now he has become one of the personal attendants of the king. Okay, let's go to the end of chapter 2. End of chapter 2, verse 48. "The king made Daniel great, gave him many great gifts, made him rule over the whole province of Babylon, made him chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel requested, and the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon." So what do we have? Promotion number 2, right? Second promotion. End of the chapter, same thing. Both chapters, it's the last verse in the chapter. Let's go to chapter 3. The end of chapter 3, verse 30. The conclusion of the chapter is, "Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to succeed in the province of Babylon." So, there's another promotion. They're getting raised up again. Chapter 4 is working a little differently because it's focused on Nebuchadnezzar. But if we go to chapter 5, when you get to the end of chapter 5, you're going to read this, verse 29. "They clothed Daniel with purple, gold chain around his neck, proclaimed concerning him to become the third ruler in the kingdom." So there's another promotion, chapter 5. And when you get to the end of chapter 6, verse 28, "This Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, even Cyrus of Persia." So what do you have? You have a pattern, very noticeable, that God keeps on blessing his people. And I'll just say this because it'll come up later. It's at the end of every chapter, isn't it? At the end of the end of the story, right? In the middle of the story, they're in the lion's den. In the middle of the story, they're in the fire. In the middle of the story, it looks like they're going to die. At the end of the story, they get promoted. They get promoted. They get promoted. So that chapters 1 through 6, it's the story of how God keeps on promoting and blessing his people. Now, it's not just that. Because together with that, what else do you have? Every chapter, you have the wicked going down. Chapters 1 through 6 are the story of how each time someone is trying to resist Daniel and his friends or resist God, they keep on being demoted. Right? And all the way down here we have, we'll just look at it here in chapter 6 since we're already here. Here's the ultimate demotion, verse 24. "The king ordered, those who slanderously charged Daniel were cast into the den of lions. They were crushed before they even touched the bottom of the den." Which is to say, there was nothing wrong with the lions. Everything's working just fine, right? It's all there. Digestion, it's all happening, right? And it wasn't an issue of the lions. These people, as soon as they're in there, they're done. Right, so the ultimate demotion of the wicked all the way through that story. Putting those two things together, you have this really striking pattern that at every step, God's people keep on being exalted and the wicked keep on being put down. Now, if you look at that and you think, sounds like prosperity theology, right? I mean, I could preach this in some places and say, if you're righteous, you will always get the promotion. Amen, right? If you're righteous, straight to the top. Hallelujah. Great. How many people do we have here that are on their track to the presidency? Yeah, see, it doesn't quite work out that way for us usually. And I have some discussion that we'll make about that later. I just want you to hold that thought in your mind. For now, I'll say this. We'll say this much. Daniel went through a lion's den too. Don't forget that. Daniel and or the three friends went through the fiery furnace too. Don't forget that. So don't just conclude if you're a Christian and a good Christian, it's always straight to the top. If you're a good Christian, right Christian, you might be in the lion's den. You might be in the fiery furnace. Don't forget that too. And Daniel hadn't read his story yet. So Daniel didn't know whether he was going to live through the lion's den or not. Right? It's, well, if I die, I die. I mean, he doesn't know. They don't know. Are they going to be burned up in the fiery furnace or not? They don't know. They haven't read the story yet. So don't forget that part of it too. But part of then what's going on then is that these persecutors trying to destroy Daniel, there's this constant tension, this fight between the two. And the book of Daniel would highlight specifically because of Daniel's God. Now, let me highlight that, or let me explain what's going on as you think through the chapter. Very striking to us ought to be. It's not just that they hate Daniel because he's promoted, but because of his God. And that's obvious because you see this from the beginning all the way through. First of all, right at the beginning of the story, you find that the king wanted to set Daniel over the whole kingdom, verse 3, because, verse 3, an excellent spirit was found in him. So he's got a good testimony. Verse 4, when they want to destroy Daniel, they knew that he was faithful and no charge or negligence could be found against him. In fact, they knew verse 5, their only chance was in the law of his God. Meaning this, it's not like Daniel kept his faith private. It's not like Daniel did his work, then he came home and he privately worshiped God. Daniel is actively letting people know about the law. He has a reputation, he's known as the law of God guy. Right? I mean, established reputation for this. And they agree on this. They go in and they set this as the expectation that they can catch him with regard to this issue with his God, following the law of his God. So when the king calls Daniel in, verse 13, they're talking again about him as the exiled sons of Judah. The king does not want to destroy Daniel. And I just want you to notice these details. Verse 20, verse 16, when the king talks to Daniel, the king's words are, "Your God whom you serve continually, may he deliver you." So even the king knows about Daniel's reputation. Verse 20, "Daniel, servant of the living God, was your God whom you serve continually able to deliver you from the lions?" Daniel has a very established reputation as one who continually serves God and obeys him. All right. All of that as a demonstration of why these people hate Daniel and trying to destroy him, because Daniel faithfully serves his God. I have a question for us here. In verse 10... it says that Daniel knew that they had inscribed the writing. He went to his house where windows had been opened in his roof chamber toward Jerusalem. Three times in the day he knelt on his knees and prayed and gave thanks before God. Okay, so my question here, is this Daniel being faithful or is he being foolish? Is he being faithful or is he being foolish to go and pray like this? Ask it this way. If the government says to us, that we're not allowed to, we're not allowed to sing hymns in church, okay? So we can preach, we can take offerings, you can have deacons, you can have fellowships, you can have outreaches, you just can't sing hymns. That's it, just pick one thing, you can't sing hymns, okay? Would it be wise for us, every time we sing a hymn, to open all the windows and all the doors, and then turn the sound system as loudly as we can, and then Facebook Live it, so that everybody can see that we're doing it? What do you think? Or could we say, all right, that's what they said. We'll still sing hymns. We won't use a piano. We'll just sing quietly, but we'll sing together. We'll still sing together. Why stir up trouble? All right, we'll sing quietly together and we'll continue doing this. What do you think? I mean, everybody open up your, turn on your phones. Let's Facebook Live this thing. We are singing hymns. Even though they said no. What do you think? No viewpoints? Who wants to take a stab at it? I think it's foolish, right? There's this video, maybe some of y'all seen it. It's called The Printing. And it's set in Russia during the communist era. And these people are printing Bibles. And the one guy's like, okay, I'm going to take my Bible and I'm going to go. And the other guy says, what are you doing? He says, well, if I need to be a martyr, I'll be a martyr. And the other guy says to him, the older pastor guy says, look, we're not trying to be martyrs. Okay. It's like, I really like, we need to go, I have a Bible! You know, just, okay, that's fine. Just put the Bible in your bag. That will be okay, right? So why does Daniel have to go up on his, look at it, up to his window, opened on his roof chamber, where everybody can see it, toward Jerusalem, three times a day, knelt on his knees and prayed. Especially when you recognize Jesus said, go into your closet, shut the door, and then pray. Daniel goes on his roof chamber with his windows open toward Jerusalem three times a day. Faith or foolish? Okay, well, maybe part of the reason we're reserved is we don't want to, we're trying, how does that fit into the flow of the story? So let me show you a couple of things. Oh, I have one more question for you. I'm sorry, then we'll go there. Why towards Jerusalem? That's another question. Why towards Jerusalem? I'll be honest with you, I don't even know from here which direction is Jerusalem. I have to think about it. So I think, what, that, like this would be north, roughly, isn't it? Either way, but I can't. My wife and I did a class, and she did some stuff teaching too in Dubai, and so we stayed in this hotel, and in the hotel on the roof there was this little arrow thingy in one corner, and I was just looking at that one day. And I said, what is that thing? You know, I'm just trying to. Well, duh, I'm in Dubai, so the arrow thing is telling you what direction is Mecca. And every room has one of those little pointers up there, because when it comes the time of day, you've got to know what direction to pray so that you can know how to pray towards Mecca. You know, it's kind of a convenience luxury thing, then you don't have to get out your compass and figure out, I guess. But, so everybody needs to know which direction. Do we do that? Did Daniel do that? Why did he need to pray toward Jerusalem? Would it not work? Like if he prayed the other way or something? If he prayed, you know, pointing towards Alaska or something. Is that, the prayers aren't going to get through? Reception's going to be bad? Why pray towards Jerusalem? Well, let's look at this. And I think I feel very strongly. This is the background for what's going on in Daniel's prayer. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 8. Just to give you context, we'll start out at the beginning or what's going on here. This is the time when Solomon has set up the temple. And it's the dedication of the temple. So it's a very dramatic time in Israel's history. It's their first, like the first full temple, right? I mean, they've had the tabernacle, they've had other places to worship that have been set up, but now they have a temple. And it has this climactic feel to it, this beautiful, powerful feel to it. So, 1 Kings chapter 8, he starts to pray. It's the dedication of the temple. And he's praying this beautiful prayer in front of the nation. So, he's standing before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the congregation of Israel, spreading forth his hands. Lord God of Israel, there is no God like thee. You have kept your promise to thy servant David, my father, what you promised. So, please, Lord, keep that promise, fulfill those promises to Israel to bless us, that God would then show his glory in this temple. Verse 29, that thine eyes might be open toward this house night and day, even toward the place of which thou hast said. And now he's going to talk about then when his people, Israel, might be conquered by others. Let's look at verse 33. When thy people Israel be smitten down before the enemy because they have sinned against thee. What does that sound like? Well, Daniel's time, the nation of Israel had been conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. When they are smitten down before the enemy because they have sinned against thee, and it was judgment because of their sin. If they shall turn again to thee and confess thy name and pray and make supplication unto thee in this house, then hear thou in heaven. Forgive the sin of thy people in Israel. Bring them again into the land which thou gavest unto their fathers. Or if their heaven is shut up and there is no rain, then hear thou in heaven. Forgive the sin of thy servants, verse 36. If, verse 37, there be in the land famine, pestilence, blasting, mildew, locust, a caterpillar. And if then, verse 38, they pray And they asked, then verse 39, hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, forgive. Give unto every man according to his ways. Verse 41, a stranger that is not of thy people, if he comes into this. Then verse 43, hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place. If verse 44, they go out into battle against their enemies and they pray. Then verse 45, hear thou in heaven their prayer. If verse 46, they sin against thee. And you are angry with them and deliver them to the enemy so that they carry them away captives unto the land of the enemy, far or near. What's that? That's the captivity. That's Daniel. That's the Babylonian captivity. If they shall bethink themselves or they realize that in the land where they were carried captives, they realize they have sinned and they repent and they make supplication to thee unto thee in the land of them that carried away captive. And they say, we have sinned and done perversely. We have committed wickedness. And so they return to you with all their heart and they pray unto you, verse 48. Have to see this. They pray unto thee toward their land which thou givest unto their fathers, the city which thou hast chosen. They pray towards the house which I have built for thy name. Then hear their prayer and their supplication in heaven. If they pray towards this house, hear and forgive and restore them, verse 50. Bring them back that they have compassion on them. Bring them back to this land so that you would hear all their prayers. There's not just 1 Kings 8:48. There are other passages that do this. And here's what I would argue. I think Daniel, certainly it's not like he has to just pray to Jerusalem or God won't hear him. I think Daniel is being so careful with his reading of the Old Testament. He's thinking of this passage. And he's going back to this passage and he's saying, down to every detail, I am going to fulfill Solomon the king 450 years ago. Prayed this prayer. And I am going to fulfill this prayer in every respect, praying toward Jerusalem. And if you want to know what that prayer sounded like, if you go ahead to chapter 9, which we will later, chapter 9, the chronology of chapter 9 lines up with chapter 6. That in chapter 9, there is an entire prayer recorded. And what it sounds like is this, Daniel saying things like, oh Lord, you warned us. You told us that if we sinned, you would judge us. You told us we would be taken captive to another land. You told us that we would be captives in another place that we knew nothing about. And you have done all your word, and we sinned, and we were the reason. Please forgive. Please return us to our land. And when Daniel is praying then towards Jerusalem, it's a fulfillment of Solomon's words. It's even an expression of Daniel's longing heart. That's my home. I've lived in Babylon my whole life. And I have prospered here, and I'm high in the government, but my home is there. I want to be back in the land that God gave to our fathers. I want to be back there to fulfill the promises God gave to Abraham. I belong there, not here. This is not my home. Some ways you could go down this track to say, even as a believer, I'm looking at the land I live in as a foreign place. My eyes are turned towards heaven. Daniel's eyes turned towards Jerusalem. That's where I belong. That's where I ought to be. What about the praying at a window? Why is he doing that? Is that necessary? Well, here's the detail that I think is critical on that. Verse 10. Daniel prayed three times a day, gave thanks before God, as he had done from times previous to this. I think that detail is critical. Verse 10, as he had done from times previous to this. And the reason I say that is this. Think about it from Daniel's perspective at this time. If Daniel chooses to start changing his behavior now because of the law, what does that communicate? All right, let's think of it that way. Hanover Baptist Church, let's say that we had been in the habit of always singing our hymns with the doors open and with the windows open and Facebook live streaming it, okay? So then a law gets passed that you can no longer sing hymns. So all of a sudden we shut our doors, we shut our windows, and we don't stream it anymore. There's almost a sense in which if you do that, you're sort of pretending that you followed the law. If Daniel three times a day had always consistently, I mean, everybody knew, you know, okay, it must be 11 o'clock. Because look, there's Daniel, right? Oh, 3 o'clock. Yeah, there he is again. He's always there. Everybody knows that Daniel consistently does this all the time. And that's clear. All these points I made all over, except in regard to his law, except in regard, your God whom you continually serve, your God whom you continually serve. We saw it four times in the passage. Everybody knows that Daniel does this all the time. What if as soon as there's a law, as soon as there's a cost, he stops? What does that communicate? And on that basis, then, I would argue, faith or foolish, well, if we were going to sing, you know, with our windows wide open, I would call that foolish. Why do that? But in Daniel's case, where he's been doing this consistently, he's praying towards Jerusalem, I would suggest this is the only way that he has to support his testimony to continue on. I think this is the only right thing to do. And it just shows us that persecution situations are complicated. It's not a simple formula that you're always going to follow with this. Part of this probably for Daniel, helpful to me just to recognize, 85-year-old man, God has been faithful to him through so many trials and through so many tests. For all these 70 years in Babylon, God has never let him down. There's almost this sense for him at this point, after all those decades of God's blessing, his faithfulness. It's like, well, this is what I'm going to do. If they kill me, they kill me. If they throw me in the lion's den, God wants me to live some more? Great. He'll keep me safe. If God's got more mileage for me to go through, sure. I'm sure he'll keep me safe. And it's almost just total confidence in God's control. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and we'll let God take care of the details as it works itself out. Okay, so that hopefully maybe can explain kind of what's going on with that. When you get to the end of this story and you see the king's response, I would suggest we don't know in Darius's or Cyrus's case, is he a believer, is he a not believer? Of course, we have no idea. I would suggest it's obvious that Daniel's testimony to him is really strong. Because the whole way through, he's saying things like, your God, whom you serve continually, was he able to deliver you from the lions? All the way to the end, this decree that is established, verse 26, in all the dominion of my kingdom, people are to tremble in fear from before the God of Daniel, because he's the true God. That wording in verse 26, his dominion will not be destroyed, his dominion will be to the end, sounds like Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, very parallel wording, and it sounds like chapter 7 that we'll get to later, the Son of Man, who will rule forever and ever. So there's some links that go across that. Last point I'll make before we take a break here is from verse 28. What do you think might be the significance of this very final line? This Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, even in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Well, I made the point way back in chapter 1. The last verse of chapter 1 made the link to Cyrus. And when you read that, you were supposed to go, during the reign of Cyrus. Cyrus! Cyrus, like Isaiah, prophecy, but like Ezra, Nehemiah, Cyrus, that's Cyrus, during the reign of... And this is the end, so you recognize, chapter 6 is the end of the historical section of the book. So we're just turning the page on part 1. This is the last page of part 1. Okay, and after this, next chapter is going to be prophecy. We're changing, this is like volume 1 out of the whole book. We're changing that section, and the last word of the section makes the link to Cyrus. Don't forget, until the reign of Cyrus. And I think this is another argument for the fact that Daniel is intentionally linked to the Cyrus edict. Return God's people back to the promised land. Because Cyrus, Daniel was there until the end. So that's why my conclusion for this chapter would be, God has still not forgotten. Chapter 1, we said that the theme, God has not forgotten. He still remembers. He's still working. He's still in control. I'd say chapter 6 is the same thing. God still has not forgotten. When Daniel was 15 years old, God had not forgotten his people. When Daniel's 85 years old, and he's actually working with Cyrus in the kingdom, God has still not forgotten. God is still in control. He's still doing great things to bring about his purposes through Daniel. So, before we take our break, let's do that. Let's write down a big idea that you took from this chapter, and then let's write down a response that you'll have. Practical, personal response. Big idea and a practical response, something that I need to do today because this is true. I think you could have an idea here, something that comes to my mind here. Just, are there times when maybe you respond in faith to the promises of God, that, okay, Lord, I'll follow you, and you're looking for some kind of solution to a problem or some kind of answer or waiting for, see God work. Sometimes time just grinds you down. So you've waited in the past decade, couple decades. Okay, Lord, I thought I would respond in faith and then you would just answer, problem solved, right? And then it's just time. And time can grind down faith more powerfully than a single event. Maybe you can make it through an event or two, but just the grinding of time. So you have something like this with Abraham, where God tells him when he's much younger, you will have a child. And decades go by, and it seems that Abraham has lost faith in the promise, right? You reach a point where Abraham doesn't really seem to have confidence, as much anyway, that this promise will be fulfilled. Sarah certainly does not. And sometimes time can grind us down. I think what you're seeing here is God has not forgotten chapter 1, Daniel's 15 years old. Okay, now Daniel's 85. Well, where is the answer to the promise? It still hasn't come. And the answer is, just wait. It's around the corner. I mean, it's probably within a couple of years of Daniel chapter 7 or Daniel chapter 6 that God fulfilled his word. It's right around the corner. So just hang on. You're almost there. And I, as I look at my life, as we all look at our lives too, okay, what things are there that I responded in faith to? And maybe the passage of time has just ground down my confidence in that. Don't quit. Nothing's changed. Same God, same truth. It's all still true. When we come back after this, we will make a transition to the next section. And I'm just showing you this. Maybe I'll leave it up on the screen for you to look at. But this shows you the chronology of the book up to this point. And this maybe is a little bit of a complicated chart. If you want to just look down at these dates. In fact, just to kind of put some visual clarity on it, I'll just roll it up like that. There we go. Okay, so if you look at these dates, I'm just giving you the dates here for each one of the chapters up to this point. And what I want you to notice is basically this. The chronology, if you look at the dates, the chronology progresses like this. So it's in order, forward progress. When you get here, it goes back and it starts over again and it goes forward progress. So you don't notice this until you actually work through and you plot out the dates. But the way that the structure of Daniel is, it's like this. Chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, chapter 12. You see? You get it? Chapters 1 through 6 is all in order. You start over with a new group, and there's another in order set of sections that are also in chronological order, but you actually backed up a little bit before you did that. And that's because chapters 7 through 12, you're going to notice, are completely different. If you read through the book already, you've seen this. They turn to prophecy instead of the narrative, instead of the history. Okay? When we come back after this, what I want to ask you is, what's the connection between that narrative, chapters 1 to 6, and the prophecy we're about to see? Are these like two separate things? How do these two pieces fit together? Why are they together in the same book? And we'll talk about that right after we take a break. So let's just come back in another 15 minutes. That'll be at 2:20. And we'll work together on Daniel chapter 7 and 8 and get into some of this prophecy section.